Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I will be with you for the next hour on this February the 1st on the West Coast, now February the 2nd on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. I'd like to also welcome those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world. And I noticed just now that we have four twos in the date. If you want to look at two, February is a two. Today is the 2nd on the East Coast. That's another two. Then we have the two in 2000, and we have 11, which is another two. Two, 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 two. That's an interesting date. That adds up to an eight, which is a number for financial gain, financial success, prosperity, abundance. Some even say luck, although I'm not one that believes in luck. Good fortune, maybe. Luck, I think, is somewhat of a stretch. I don't have a guest tonight, and yet you are going to hear two other individuals, at least, actually four other individuals. If we get around to everything I have planned for tonight, I'm going to preface tonight's show with a short remark before we listen to a little bit of music that sort of reflects the consciousness of what's going on the earth, and at the same time, this dichotomy of being in a energy vortex that spins around and spirals. And, you know, how we make use of energy is totally up to us, just like how we make use of information. Are we going to let the information spin us around, or are we going to allow ourselves to direct or manifest our future? Are we going to create our future by understanding how nature supplies the energy to us and offers us energy grids that we can tune into, which we can use for our physical health, our mental health, or our thought patterns, and our connection to the universe? The energy's there, whether you realize it or not. And if it affects you, is it affecting you in a positive way or in a negative way? Is it making the quality of your life richer? Are you understanding what's going on in your life, or are you merely a leaf in the wind, so to speak? I'm going to start off tonight doing something I haven't done in quite a while, and that's playing some of my own music. You get to hear my music on the theme song, but seldom do I actually play something that I've composed. And this is a song that I intend to have on my next solo CD. This is called Spirals. Thank you. Yep, that's yours truly, Spirals. Reminds me of the first time I stood in an energy vortex and experienced a tremendous swirling energy. And what that song did was basically encapsulate that feeling and translated it into music. Simple. And it's what's interesting is the song is replete with tone spirals throughout. So it's sort of a dichotomy of itself. I alluded last night at the end of the show that I would be talking about mind control and propaganda and a particular ethnic type of propaganda that has infiltrated our government and our country and our way of life. And if you doubt this at all, by the end of this show, you certainly will agree that it's highly plausible. In fact, you'll say that I'm right on the money. Last year, I brought out a series of exposés on the infiltration of one Dwight David Eisenhower, who I deduced was actually Johann Adolf Eisenhower, the illegitimate son of Franz Joseph I, Emperor of Austria-Hungary. That's a hard pill for a lot of people to swallow because upon his leaving office, he made an exit speech at West Point where he said that we were in danger of a military industrial complex. At the time, he edited out the word congressional because he actually had written military-industrial-congressional complex. Of course, was he alerting us to this peril, or was he actually signaling to those for whom he was working secretly that it was mission accomplished? If you remember when George W. Bush got on a Navy ship and announced mission accomplished. Basically, this was setting up the pretext for another war with Iraq and Afghanistan and setting up the military industrial congressional complex to make a lot of money. They've been making trillions of dollars with these bogus wars, and they turn around and call anyone who speaks out against these things terrorists, when in actuality, if you just look at 9/11 and view the film September Clues, if you have any doubts about the fraud that was committed, that is an absolutely brilliant production analyzing all the mistakes that were made by mainstream media in delivering a scripted message. They really flubbed it. They messed up big time. And my hat's off to Simon Shack, who produced that production, September Clues. It's an 8-part expose on 9/11 that shows who was actually behind it. Not just the lies and the mistakes that were made as this thing unfolded before the eyes of the world. You see, the media serves as a propaganda tool. And despite what the history books say, despite the recorded speeches of many, many politicians, be they presidents, senators, congressmen, mayors, aspirants to political office, the wealthy in the military-industrial complex, it really doesn't matter. They have an agenda. That agenda was outlined in a book written and published in 1953 by one T.H. Teetons. The book is called Germany Plots with the Kremlin. In fact, I have a PDF version of that book posted on my website, directlightproductions.com, and on the documents page, actually. You can download that free of charge, and you can read it for yourself. But I'd like to read the opening of the book. The very introduction of the book begins with what is called an open letter to President Eisenhower, and this is from T.H. Teton's. Mr. President, in this book, Germany Plots with the Kremlin, I have assembled documents exposing the ominous situation which has developed out of our German policy. This policy is leading our people into a trap which has been carefully prepared by German planners. The very freedom and independence of America is at stake, as revealed by these documents. While the free world is busy organizing its strength in the struggle against the Soviet bloc, Germany's geopolitical masterminds have quietly sharpened the weapons from their time-tested arsenal of realpolitik. They have mapped out a bold plan aimed at undoing our military victories. They hope to achieve this goal by a treacherous sellout of Europe to Moscow, a scheme that would entail economic and political disaster for the United States. As a political analyst who has spent a lifetime in fighting Germany's bid for world conquest in two world wars, I see the old plot emerging again in the words and deeds of the new Germany. The Bonn Republic under Dr. Adenauer pursues, and that's Konrad Adenauer, by the way, pursues the same pattern which was applied so successfully under the Weimar Republic. Again, the German leaders profess their attachment to the West in order to extract from the American taxpayer billions of dollars. Once we have enabled Germany to recapture her pre-war military strength, she will again offer it to Moscow as her contribution to the common front against the West. We have not learned our lessons from the past. Twice within a generation, we went to war in order to stop German aggression. Each time we gained military victory, only to throw it away by making Germany strong again as a bulwark against the East. That policy has always backfired against its architects. This was proven in 1922 at Rapallo and in 1939 in the Moscow-Berlin Pact. After World War I, the United States put Germany back on her feet with generous political concessions and huge loans. But shortly thereafter, the German industrialists, politicians, and generals turned toward Moscow and made their economic, political, and military deals against the West. If the Germans have their way, it will happen again. If events take that course, then the United States will indeed be faced with the greatest disaster in her history. All of our planning since 1945 will have turned out to be the preparation which hastens our economic and political suicide. Mr. President, there is no one alive today who is more aware of the importance of the German problem than yourself. 8 years ago, you saw the consequences of their actions at first hand. There is not the slightest proof that their behavior and political outlook have changed or that they can be considered a reliable ally. On the contrary, events in Germany prove that the old Nazis, the Pan-Germans, and the militarists moved into positions of command again. Through American-sponsored elections, they have reconstituted their parliamentary strength. The Bonn government is blackmailing the Western powers to obtain the freedom of the last few hundred war criminals. With ever-increasing frequency, monster rallies are staged where thousands of rabble-rousing Nazis and former officers demonstrate their contempt for America. Large sections of the German population support these Nazi-like outbursts. At a recent mass meeting of Hitler's Waffen-SS, you, Mr. President, were labeled the real war criminal and branded with the favorite German epithet, Schweinehund. American officials, led astray by wishful thinking, have tried to paint Germany as a country infused with the spirit of democracy. However, the documents published in this book tell a different story. They prove from the plotters' own mouths how Germany plans to put the United States against the wall. There is no doubt in my mind that our fallacious policies have accelerated rather than decreased the building up of new potential German-Russo of a new potential German-Russo coalition. To those who see the danger but hope to buy it off with additional billion-dollar injections, the documents in this book prove that with each injection, Germany's attraction for Moscow will grow as her potentialities are enhanced. This will make a deal more profitable for both of the former partners of the Berlin-Moscow axis. It is strange, but nonetheless true, that while all of our major changes in foreign policy have been debated in Congress and in public forums, the paramount question of Germany and the vital changes in our post-war policy have never had the close scrutiny either in the Congress or in public debate, which this number one American problem demands. Germany plots with the Kremlin has been written to place our government, the American people, on guard. If this book opens the much-needed debate on our German policy, it will have fulfilled its purpose. Mr. President, after reading this book, you will agree that there must be a change. We must re-examine our German policy in order to regain our freedom of action in Europe and to preserve our moral leadership in the free world. With this thought in mind, and as a warning to the nation, I bring this book with its documentation to your special attention. Respectfully yours, T.H. Teetons, Cooperstown, New York, February 1953. Of course, this letter went unanswered, and most likely the book was even unread, at least by the president. Now, would someone in the CIA or then the OSS, would they have, or prior to that, the OSS, would they have read this book? Most likely, they would have perused every single letter in it and considered its connection to what they knew, because they had already secreted a large number, thousands of German scientists, as they like to say, but many, probably many, many more spies into the United States. My research on Dwight Eisenhower revealed that he himself was an infiltrator. So basically, it's like going to the man that you think is the manager of the bank, telling him you know who robbed the bank, when in reality the bank robber works for the bank and is probably the best friend of the bank manager. Something to consider. Now, what Teetons is revealing here really reared its ugly head again in my Eisenhower research. What made this research unique amongst all the World War II researchers, any presidential researcher or historian, and I don't say this braggingly, I don't say this to put a feather in my cap, but to show you how significant the research I did on Dwight David Eisenhower, who was born David Dwight Eisenhower, to two parents, Jacob Eisenhower. And I actually have to pause for a moment to Ida Stover, to think of her name, Ida Stover, because these were fictional characters. These were not real people. These names were made up to fit the stories that were made up to infiltrate the country, which Eisenhower, who was allegedly born on October 14th of 1890 in Denison, Texas, actually was born at a different time in Austria-Hungary, in Solca-Bukovina district of Austria-Hungary, very close to where Transylvania is, in fact. It's very, very interesting research. I was able to document an individual that had set up the means through which they were going to finance this infiltration, and which they did finance the infiltration, and which they are using to this day to systematically take over the real estate, the educational system, and the governments on a local, county, state, and federal level of this country, of the United States. This is important research, folks. I don't say it because I did it. But I can tell you that the documents that show the scams that were run through the Veterans Administration, the creation of non-entities into the system to receive financial benefits, and the creation of phony dependents who would collect when these mystical members of the U.S. military were killed off in battles that sometimes didn't even occur or were used as a matter of convenience to collect dependent benefits upon the alleged death of these fictitious people. One Lonnie Roberts, who ran the ring, used a number of aliases, which I discovered, and used a U.S. post office box in Denison, Texas, which also happened to be the place where Barack Obama's alleged grandparents operated out of once they left Oklahoma City. This is an international spy ring, folks, set up by the then communist Soviet Republic. Were Nazis involved? Absolutely. Nazis, as Teton's pointed out in his book, the Nazis and the communists, who preferred to call themselves the socialists, it was communism, just under a different name. They set this whole thing up. We were told that we joined the UN on October 24th of 1945. Yet, what we found out from another individual who managed a program called the Lend-Lease Program, which was under the authority of the UN or the United Nations, a name contributed by the Soviets, by the way, on the 1st of January 1942. And we began financing the Soviet Union's participation throughout World War II. We paid for everything. Roosevelt gave away all of our nuclear secrets. All of them. All of this was accounted for by the man that ran the Lend-Lease program, which began in Newark, New Jersey, and ended up in Montana at Malmstrom Air Force Base. This ring had a connection up in Alaska as well. They found that munitions and all sorts of spare parts and equipment that had been paid for by the American taxpayers buried in the snow alongside the runways at the airports. Crates and crates and crates of everything you can imagine. This was done while the focus was on the Nazis. They were not alone in subjugating the integrity of the U.S. Constitution, its land, its banking system, its military, industrial, and congressional complex. The state of Texas alone must have had 40 or 50 communists in power as mayors, as state senators, as secretaries of state. And I can definitely tie Lyndon Johnson to that group, both in his participation in the subversive activities that funneled cash to this group. He was a major player in that. The documentation is on my website, the letters to and from Lonnie Roberts to Lyndon Baines Johnson are posted there within those articles. Teenage Mutant Ninja Eisenhower's and Teenage Mutant Ninja birth certificates. Those articles detail much of this. The proof is there. I didn't write the letters. The letters were retrieved from a file cabinet that was removed from a burning house, likely a house that Lonnie Roberts lived in. I deduced that Lonnie Roberts was one of the Eisenhower brothers. It was a very large family, much larger than what was publicized in the historical accounts. And the pictures that were offered to us as the parents were actually other relatives. One was the mother, but her name was not Ida Stover. Ida Stover was a fiction, a total fiction. And again, we had a Wizard of Oz set up, Kansas. Who would do this but an Ashkenazi, a Zionist, which the autocrat Franz Joseph I from the, and I should add, von Habsburg, was. He was an Ashkenazi, he was a Zionist, and he was an autocratic ruler of Austria-Hungary for 68 years. One of his relatives ended up being the cause of World War I. At least they used that as the excuse. He had another relative that was an emperor or king, if you want to use that word, of Mexico. When do we hear about that? So infiltrating countries is not a new thing. It's been done a lot. We've got a Hungarian as the president of France, running the EU, which facilitates the money laundering that's going on between Washington and New York and Frankfurt and the city of London and all the major financial centers of the world. You might as well throw in Hong Kong as well, and Beijing, North Korea, India, Japan. This is worldwide, folks. This financial corruption is supporting all these subversive activities. These things are planned long range. Certainly, this isn't something that I discovered. It's been out there. I'm going to play you an excerpt just to underscore the importance of what I've been talking about. There's a man known as Thomas Schumann. Thomas Schumann is an alias for a KGB spy, Yuri Bezmenov. And he was interviewed in 1985 by a former guest on this show and the founder of Freedom Force International and the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, G. Edward Griffin. This portion of the interview is about ideological indoctrination. This is a man who allegedly, as a diplomat in India, who also worked for Novosti, the Russian press, Soviet press, was a double agent, at least, maybe even a triple agent, and interviewed after his defection from the Soviet Union. Listen carefully to his words.
Our conversation is with Mr. Yuri Alexandrovich Bezmenov. Mr. Bezmenov was born in 1939 in a suburb of Moscow. He was the son of a high-ranking Soviet Army officer. He was educated in the elite schools inside the Soviet Union and became an expert in Indian culture and Indian languages. He had an outstanding career with Novosti, which was the, and still is, I should say, the press arm or the press agency of the Soviet Union. It turns out that this is also a front for the KGB. He escaped to the West in 1970 after becoming totally disgusted with the Soviet system, and he did this at great risk to his life. He certainly is one of the world's outstanding experts on the subject of Soviet propaganda and disinformation and active measures. When the Soviets use the phrase ideological subversion, what do they mean by it?
Ideological subversion is the process which is legitimate, overt, and open. You can see it with your own eyes. All you have to do, all American mass media has to do, is to unplug their bananas from their ears, open up their eyes, and they can see it. There's no mystery. There's nothing to do with espionage. I know that espionage intelligence gathering looks more romantic. It sells more deodorants through the advertising, probably. That's why your Hollywood producers are so crazy about James Bond type of thrillers. But in reality, the main emphasis of the KGB is not in the area of intelligence at all. According to my opinion and opinion of many defectors of my caliber, only about 15% of time, money, and manpower is spent on espionage as such. The other 85% is a slow process, which we call either ideological subversion or active measures, активные мероприятия in the language of the KGB, or psychological warfare. What it basically means is to change the perception of reality of every American to such an extent that despite of the abundance of information, no one is able to come to sensible conclusions in the interests of defending themselves, their families, their community, and their country. It's a great brainwashing process which goes very slow, and it's divided in four basic stages. The first one being demoralization. It takes from 15 to 20 years to demoralize a nation. Why that many years? Because this is the minimum number of years which requires to educate one generation of students in the country of your enemy, exposed to the ideology of the enemy. In other words, Marxism-Leninism ideology is being pumped into the soft heads of at least three generations of American students without being challenged or counterbalanced by the basic values of Americanism, American patriotism. Most of the activity of that department was to compile huge amount, volume of information on individuals who were instrumental in creating public opinion. Publishers, editors, journalists, actors, educationalists, professors of political science, members of parliament, representatives of business circles. Most of these people were divided roughly into groups. Those who would toe the Soviet foreign policy, they would be promoted to the positions of power through media and public opinion manipulation. Those who refused the Soviet influence in their own country would be character assassinated or executed physically, counter-revolution. Same way as in the small town of Hue in South Vietnam, several thousands of Vietnamese were executed in one night when the city was captured by Viet Cong for only 2 days. And American CIA could never figure out how could possibly communists know each individual, where he lives, where to get him, and would be arrested in one night, basically in some 4 hours before dawn, put on a van, taken out of the city limits and shot. The answer is very simple. Long before communists occupied the city, there was extensive network of informers, local Vietnamese citizens, who knew absolutely everything about people who are instrumental in public opinion, including barbers and taxi drivers. Everyone who was sympathetic to the United States was executed. Same thing was done under the guidance of the Soviet embassy in Hanoi, and same thing I was doing in New Delhi. To my horror, I discovered that in the files where people were doomed to execution, there were names of pro-Soviet journalists with whom I was personally friendly.
Pro-Soviet?
Yes. They were idealistically minded leftists who made several visits to USSR. And yet, the KGB decided that counter-revolution or drastic changes in political structure of India, they will have to go.
Why is that?
Because they know too much. Simply because, you see, the useful idiots, the leftists who are idealistically believing in the beauty of Soviet socialist or communist or whatever system, when they get disillusioned, they become the worst enemies. That's why my KGB instructors specifically made the point, never bother with leftists. Forget about these political prostitutes. Aim higher. This was my instruction. Try to get into large circulation, established conservative media, rich, filthy rich movie makers, intellectuals, so-called academic circles, cynical, egocentric people who can look into your eyes with angelic expression and tell you a lie. These are the most recruitable people, people who lack moral principles, who are either too greedy or too suffer from self-importance. They feel that they matter a lot. These are the people who KGB wanted very much to recruit.
But to eliminate the others, to execute the others, don't they serve some purpose? Wouldn't they be the ones
they
rely on?
They serve purpose only at the stage of destabilization of a nation. For example, your leftists in the United States, all these professors and all these beautiful civil rights defenders, they are instrumental in the process of the subversion only to destabilize the nation. When their job is completed, they are not needed anymore. They know too much. Some of them, when they get disillusioned, when they see that Marxist-Leninists has come to power, obviously they get offended. They think that they will come to power. That will never happen, of course. They will be lined up against the wall and shot. But they may turn into the most bitter enemies of Marxist-Leninists when they come to power. And that's what happened in Nicaragua. You remember most of this. Former Marxist-Leninists were either put to prison or one of them split, and now he's working against Sandinistas. It happened in Grenada when Maurice Bishop was already a Marxist. He was executed by a new Marxist who was more Marxist than this Marxist. Same happened in Afghanistan when first there was Taraki, he was killed by Amin, then Amin was killed by Babrak Karmal with the help of KGB. Same happened in Bangladesh when Mujibur Rahman, very pro-Soviet leftist, was assassinated by his own Marxist-Leninist military comrades. It's the same pattern everywhere. The moment they serve their purpose, all the useful idiots are used to either be executed entirely, all the idealistically minded Marxists, or exiled or put in prisons, like in Cuba. Many, many former Marxists are in Cuba, in prison. So basically, America is stuck with demoralization. And unless, even if you start right now, here, this minute, you start educating new generation of Americans, it will still take you 15 to 20 years to turn the tide of ideological perception of reality back to normalcy and patriotism.
Now, if what Mr. Bezmenov said is true, then he's agreeing with T.H. Teton's, number one, and the blame doesn't fall merely on the shoulders of the Nazis. But so far, notice he hasn't mentioned the Ashkenazis. That name, Nazi, I have proposed, comes from the word Ashkenazi, those that control the banks, those that control the military-industrial complex, the pharmaceutical companies, the petroleum industry, the religious institutions, and, as he described, education. So when you look at a generation, say, up through early college or through college age, he used the term 15 to 20 years. We're well into the second generation from when that broadcast was made alone. By the way, I have to apologize. The dropouts and or volume changes are not my fault. They're part of this recording. But nonetheless, we can pick up where it pauses or drops out. When I'm not hearing anything or you're not hearing anything, neither one of us is hearing it, so you're not missing anything. One overwhelming feeling I get is that this alleged defection from the Soviet Union might it in and of itself be another type of disguised infiltration. That everyone is obviously interested, but why would this information be coming out in 1985? Is it because the Soviets had determined that they had sufficiently indoctrinated and infiltrated the country? Well, if you trust my research on Eisenhower and the revelations that came out from that research, which were tangential, the revelation about our participation in the UN and the Lend-Lease program and that we financed the Soviet Union in the war, why is it that we went into a Cold War with the country that should have been on our side? Well, their intention from the outset was to infiltrate, and the very fact that the UN was created and gifted by the Rockefellers with a building and land that is territorial, non-United States land, shows that they had already succeeded at that as early as January 1st, 1942, when they signed the agreement. And by the way, the United States was the first country whose name was on that document. Great Britain was the second. Consider that. So is Mr. Bezmenov speaking totally the truth, or is his role as a KGB spy agent, former diplomat, former journalist, his cover, was he sent here to deliver this message, to give us a feeling that this is what the Soviets are doing, or these are their plans, this is how they operated, this is how they formed their communist system, and if we know this, then we can stop it? This is 1985, 43 years after this whole process began officially, where we financed it. Why would we go into a Cold War with a country like that? Well, the Cold War was a pretense for continuing these wars in other parts of the world, and they're still going on today. The war to end all wars, World War I, didn't end all wars. It was the introduction to World War II. And it came on the heels of the Boer Wars in South Africa. The slaughter of hundreds of millions of people on this planet went overlooked, and granted, many, many Jews died. I don't dispute that at all. But the Jews and the Ashkenazis are not the same people. The ones that profited from the death of the Jews, or the death of the Turks or the Armenians, and many, many Russian people. Millions and millions and millions of Russians were murdered in the Bolshevik Revolution. And the Nazis didn't help it any in two world wars. So let's get as much as we can. I mean, history's been obfuscated from us. But there are those of us who are uncovering the lies that we've been told. And when you consider where this has taken us today, in information technology, in the scams that are being run, that are causing people to be foreclosed on their homes, all the fraud that's being committed worldwide over the, not just over the internet, but the internet plays a major role. What is going on in space? We have been in bed with the Soviet Union. How is that that our government willingly does this? We have been infiltrated. It's simple. We have been infiltrated. And I coined a word, infiltrators. These are people whose interest is not in the well-being of the United States. They're on a mission to destroy it. You have such an administration right now. And I'm not the only one on the planet that sees that. Most of the world recognizes this. Sadly, many of our own people are asleep. I continue now with part two of the ideological indoctrination talk from Yuri Bezmenov with G. Edward Griffin.
Are now occupying the positions of power in the government, civil service, business, mass media, educational system. You are stuck with them. You cannot get rid of them. They are contaminated. They are programmed to think and react to certain stimuli in a certain pattern. You cannot change their mind, even if you expose them to authentic information, even if you prove that white is white and black is black. You still cannot change the basic perception and the logic of behavior. In other words, these people, the process of demoralization is complete and irreversible. To get rid society of these people, you need another 20 or 15 years to educate a new generation of patriotically minded and common sense people who would be acting in favor and in the interests of the United States society.
And yet these people who've been programmed and, as you say, in place and yes. who are favorable to an opening with the Soviet concept, mm-hmm. these are the very people who would be marked for extermination in this country?
Most of them, yes. Mm-hmm. Simply because the psychological shock when they will see in future what the beautiful society of equality and social justice means in practice, obviously they will revolt. They will be very unhappy, frustrated people. And the Marxist-Leninist regime does not tolerate these people. They will join the links of dissenters, mm-hmm. dissidents. Yeah. Unlike in present United States, there will be no place for dissent in future Marxist-Leninist America. Here you can get popular like Daniel Ellsberg and filthy rich like Jane Fonda for being dissident, for criticizing your Pentagon. In future, these people will be simply squashed like cockroaches. Nobody is going to pay them nothing for their beautiful, noble ideas of equality. This they don't understand, and it will be the greatest shock for them, of course. The demoralization process in the United States is basically completed already. For the last 25 years, actually it's overfulfilled, because demoralization now reaches such areas where previously not even Comrade Andropov and all his experts would even dream of such a tremendous success. Most of it is done by Americans to Americans, thanks to lack of moral standards. As I mentioned before, exposure to true information does not matter anymore. A person who was demoralized is unable to assess true information. The facts tell nothing to him. Even if I shower him with information, with authentic proof, with documents, with pictures, even if I take him by force to the Soviet Union and show him concentration camp, he will refuse to believe it until he is going to receive a kick in his fat bottom. When a military boot crashes, then he will understand, but not before that. That's the tragic of the situation of demoralization. So the next stage is destabilization. This time, subverter does not care about your ideas and the patterns of your consumption. Whether you eat junk food and get fat and flabby, it doesn't matter anymore. This time, and it takes only from 2 to 5 years to destabilize a nation, what matters is essentials. Economy, foreign relations, defense systems. And you can see it quite clearly that in some areas, in such sensitive areas as defense, an economy, the influence of Marxist-Leninist ideas in the United States is absolutely fantastic. I could never believe it 14 years ago when I landed in this part of the world that the process will go that fast. The next stage, of course, is crisis. It may take only up to 6 weeks to bring a country to the verge of crisis. You can see it in Central America now. And after crisis, with a violent change of power, structure, and economy, you have so-called the period of normalization. It may last indefinitely. Normalization is a cynical expression borrowed from Soviet propaganda. When the Soviet tanks moved into Czechoslovakia in 1968, Comrade Brezhnev said, "Now the situation in brotherly Czechoslovakia is normalized." This is what will happen in the United States if you allow all these schmucks to bring the country to crisis, to promise people all kind of goodies and the paradise on earth, to destabilize your economy, to eliminate the principle of free market competition, and to put a big brother government in Washington, D.C., with benevolent dictators like Walter Mondale, who will promise lots of things, never mind whether the promises are fulfillable or not. He will go to Moscow to kiss the bottoms of new generation of Soviet assassins, never mind. He will create false illusions that the situation is under control. Situation is not under control. Situation is disgustingly out of control. Most of the American politicians, media, and educational system trains another generation of people who think they are living at a peacetime. False. the United States is in a state of war, undeclared total war against the basic principles and the foundations of this system. And the initiator of this war is not Comrade Andropov, of course. It's the system, however ridiculous it may sound, the world communist system or the world communist conspiracy, whether I scare some people or not, I don't give a hoot. If you are not scared by now, nothing can scare you. But you don't have to be paranoid about it. What actually happens now, that unlike myself, you have literally several years to live on unless the United States wake up. The time bomb is ticking. That every second, the disaster is coming closer and closer. Unlike myself, you will have nowhere to defect to. Unless you want to live in Antarctica with penguins. This is it. This is the last country of freedom and possibility.
Okay, so what do we do? What is your recommendation to the American people?
Well, the immediate thing that comes to my mind is, of course, there must be a very strong national effort to educate people in the spirit of real patriotism, number one. Number two, to explain them the real danger of socialist, communist, whatever, welfare state, big brother government. If people will fail to grasp the impending danger of that development, nothing ever can help United States. You may kiss goodbye to your freedom, including freedoms to homosexuals, to prison inmate. All this freedom will vanish, evaporate in 5 seconds, including your precious lives. The second thing, the moment at least part of United States population is convinced that the danger is real, they have to force their government. And I'm not talking about sending letters, signing petitions, and all this beautiful, noble activity. I'm talking about forcing United States government to stop aiding communism.
No, I couldn't agree more with what Mr. Bezmenov said here. Yet the question of the infiltration that has occurred has not arrived. It has not surfaced. And I'm going to ask Don Newsom at BBS to graciously allow me a little bit more time to play another clip. This is from an alleged former KGB spy, Professor Oleg Kalugin, and his talk about these matters. This is out of the mouth of a spy who, by the way, was at the time of this interview, was living in Washington, D.C.
From the nation's capital, the Conservative Caucus presents Conservative Roundtable, an in-depth look at today's most important issues.
Welcome to Conservative Roundtable. I'm Howard Phillips. We're very pleased to have as our guest for this broadcast, Oleg Kalugin. Mr. Kalugin is now a professor at the Center of Counterintelligence and Security Studies in the Washington, D.C. area. He formerly served as a major general with the KGB. He left Russia in 1995 and has become a very popular commentator on American television and in the media generally in this country. Mr. Kalugin, thank you so much for coming.
That's a pleasure.
Let me begin by asking, why did you leave Russia in 1995?
Well, there was a very simple reason. I was involved in business, like thousands of my former colleagues from the KGB who retired or left the KGB in protest or in disgust after the collapse of the USSR. So I was in business, and I was involved with AT&T at some point. And I was very instrumental in opening up a joint venture with the Russian telecommunication company in AT&T. As a result, I was invited by AT&T to come to the United States and, well, help promote their business on the post-Soviet space, that is, in Russia and former republics of the USSR. My initial contract was for 3 years, and I thought I would go back. But then things started to change in Russia, and I got stuck here. Not that I regret now, that's fine.
Tell me about your career as a young man. What kind of education did you have, and what led you into the KGB, and what did you do while you were there?
Well, I was born and raised in Leningrad, now St. Petersburg. My father was a KGB officer, a junior captain. That was the highest rank he had. But I was a young and dedicated man, like most of my generation. Stalin was still alive. We had no doubts about the Soviet system. We were fully isolated from the outside world. And we grew and had faith in our system. So when I graduated from high school, I thought the best way to serve my country and the cause, the communist cause, would be to join the KGB. Partly my father's background helped, but also the general atmosphere in the country. Public service, a great cause to fight for and die for. So I joined on my own, and I applied. I had no problem with clearance because of my father's background. I was accepted to the Institute of Foreign Languages under the auspices of the KGB, and I studied English and German and Western history, civilization, other subjects. Later, I was invited to the intelligence school in Moscow, and I studied Arabic, and I, in fact, was supposed to be an Arab specialist and go to Cairo after graduation from the intelligence school. But instead, I came to the United States as a Fulbright scholar in 1958, Columbia University School of Journalism. And that was the beginning of my intelligence career in the United States, and ever since I've been with the United States.
Now, when you became a Fulbright scholar, was it understood by those who sponsored you that you were active in the KGB?
Oh, if you mean the Russian side, yeah.
On the American
side. Oh, no. We were all, I actually posed as a student of the University of Leningrad, the philological faculty. And in fact, I spent some time at the university to make my cover, you know, more
believable,
right. So when we came to the United States, a group of 18, the first Soviet students ever to come to the United States after World War II. In the group of 18, 10 were officers of the intelligence services, 6 KGB, 4 GRU, military intelligence, 7 were cooptees of the KGB informants, and only one man was exempt from any affiliations, Mr. Yakovlev. He would later become known worldwide as an architect of perestroika, Mr. Gorbachev's right hand and the closest associates.
Do you believe that your American hosts had any awareness of your connection to the KGB?
No, none at the time. I was a bona fide, you know, I mean, I tried my best, I studied well. As a matter of fact, the New York Times featured, my person in a Man in the News column and, after my graduation from Columbia, and they talked about me as a true Soviet student who wanted to learn more about the United States and how I... was well accepted by the Americans, and how I was good. I mean, not a word, not a, a shade of,
This was in the
1950s? 1959, my graduation from Columbia. And, my first recruitment, by the way, of an American, occurred also at that time, in 1959. He was a guy who had Russian background, but an American citizen with clearance, access to classified information. And he was a leftist,
So he was philosophically compatible.
Right, close. But he was sort of pro-Chinese. At that time, the Soviet-Chinese relations were already deteriorating, and he represented the Chinese wing. And I wonder how he got a job with a major U.S. company, which was involved in the research and manufacture of solid fuel for missiles. And that's what I obtained from him because I persuaded him and I told him that the best way to contribute to the eventual triumph of communism is by making the USSR stronger, I mean, in the area of science and military. And that was his contribution. I said, if you are a true socialist, well, why don't you do something? I mean, not just words, but deeds.
So what did you do in the 60s?
Well, I came back to the United States 7 months later as a Radio Moscow correspondent at the United Nations. That was another cover job. And in this capacity, I served in New York for the next 4 years. Now, in 64, I was recalled back to Moscow because of the defection of one of the KGB officers. And when dust settled down, and it was clear that I was not involved, I mean, and was not compromised, I went back to the United States, this time as a diplomat, just to make sure that I will have immunity from potential...
So you were in the Soviet embassy.
Right. So this is my third tour of duties at the Soviet embassy in Washington on the 16th Street press officer of the embassy of the USSR. Right. And Deputy Chief of Intelligence. Already I was some kind of a...
Deputy Chief of Intelligence for the mission or for the whole Soviet Union?
No, for the Washington KGB station.
Right opposite the National Geographic Society.
Yeah, absolutely, right. Yeah. Next door to the University Club as well.
Right.
And the Washington Post.
Right. How long did you do that?
Well, another 5 years. In this capacity, I served for the next 5 years. And in 1970... I was recalled back to Moscow, and because of, some good performance, I was promoted, became deputy chief of the directorate, and within the next 3 years, chief of the directorate of foreign counterintelligence, which was a major outfit in the Soviet intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Did you...
So for the next 10 years, I served at the center, at the headquarters.
Did you travel widely?
Oh, yeah, I did. I traveled far and wide with the prime mission of inspection, so-called.
Mm-hmm.
Inspections mean looking after, I mean, see if our guys in Tokyo or in Morocco or wherever, that they do their job well. But also another reason, we were supposed to meet some assets. That was an instruction from our former boss, Andropov. He said, we must always stay in touch with realities of life. We must not become bureaucrats who would just, read books and
right.
cables. You have to work with people. So I met quite a few assets.
Was Africa of significance at that time?
Africa in the 60s and the 70s was a major field of battlefield, I would say, between the Western powers, the United States in particular, and the USSR. For the minds of the Africans, newly emerging states were the really battleground. We wanted them to be on our side. In some ways, we succeeded. Ethiopia, Somalia, well, Ghana to a degree, Mali, Angola, finally, Congo, it was split. I mean, civil war, Lumumba was wild man. I mean...
What was your connection with the Lumumba school?
Well, the Lumumba School was located in Moscow,
right.
And I was operational outside the USSR. That was the difference. I was not involved in domestic affairs at all.
I have a friend, an ex-communist, from what was Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. Who was recruited by Joshua Nkomo.
Mm-hmm.
And spent time at the Lumumba School and related to me some aspects of it.
Well, I do know that Lumumba School, one of the training grounds, by the Soviet KGB, including and the military, they would select the guys who were, pliant enough to be willing to accept Soviet, instructions and guidance, and then would turn them into agents.
This was in the 70s.
That's correct.
Before we go to our break, tell us a little bit about what you did in the 80s.
Well, in the 80s, something happened in between. In the late 70s, when one of my former assets was arrested by the KGB for alleged espionage as a CIA agent, I had a choice either to ignore the fact that he was arrested, so the hell with him, I was already a big shot, or stand up and defend the man, because I did not believe he was a CIA agent. And that cost me my career, because no one in 79 in his sound mind would challenge the justice of the KGB. I did.
Now, who was Brezhnev still in then?
Oh, yeah, Brezhnev was still very much alive.
It was before Chernyenko and
Andropov. Right. It was end of 79. And because of my insubordination of sorts, I was relieved of my duties in the intelligence service and reassigned to counterintelligence, domestic, in my native city, Leningrad.
We're going to have to stop there and take a break, and we're going to go into the very interesting next chapter in the life of our distinguished guest right after these messages. Please stay with us. Hi, I'm Howard Phillips, chairman of the Conservative Caucus. I'm inviting you to learn more about the Conservative Caucus, a grassroots public policy action organization that was founded in 1974. Whether you're opposed to socialized medicine, interested in making Congress more accountable, stopping the New World Order, fighting gun control, reducing taxes, or restoring America to its biblical premises and constitutional boundaries, we're the organization you're looking for. Please call the number on your screen to get more information about our work.
For more information, write the Conservative Caucus, 450 Maple Avenue East, Vienna, Virginia, 22180, or call 703-938-9626. Here's how you can become a citizen lobbyist and influence how your representatives vote. Write a letter to your congressmen and senators. Speak out on a call-in talk radio program. Write a letter to the editor of your local newspaper and call the Conservative Caucus for more information at 703-938-9626.
Welcome back. I'm Howard Phillips. Our guest for this edition of Conservative Roundtable is former KGB Major General Oleg Kalugin. Mr. Kalugin, you brought us up to the 1980s and the period when you reported to Yuri Andropov in the Soviet Intelligence Ministry. What happened then? What was the next step in your career?
Well, because of my insubordination, the fact that I decided to defend someone who was accused by the KGB, cost me my career. And I was reassigned to the domestic counterintelligence. It was Mr. Andropov's personal decision.
But so even though he had liked your work before...
He did like, but I was
He wanted to protect you, but there were limits to what he could do to protect
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. And I also aroused some displeasure, some of his immediate subordinates, right. Some senior officials... But I was not really mistreated. I was given a job of a number two man in Leningrad field office, which had almost 3,000 men under my command. And I had all the perks preserved. I was immediately elected a member of the regional party committee.
You were still Major General?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, everything was fine. In fact... some people predicted that I will take over the Leningrad office and become the member of the collegium of the KGB, and my future was very rosy. Well, I had my own suspicions about these things because I knew the true reason. People often did not understand why all of a sudden a successful officer is assigned to the provincial, though St. Petersburg is a great city,
sure.
But still it's a province by all standards. But what made me a different man, truly, was my involvement in the Russian domestic affairs. For the first time, after nearly 25 years in the intelligence, I had to deal with my own people. Not Americans, not Germans, not Japanese. I would have to keep an eye on the Soviets, who would not keep their mouths shut, who would say something which was unpleasant or critical of the Soviet system. And at that time, there was a growing criticism among the Russians because the Soviet leadership did not deliver what they had promised. And people were grumbling. There was a feeling of frustration, disillusionment, and the growing number of people who would want to become dissidents. So my job was to ferret out these dissidents and put them in jail or psychiatric institutions. This is something which which I did not well want to do. And I, at some point, I thought I made a major error in my life by choosing to become a KGB officer. Because I always thought that KGB is, well, espionage. I mean, intrigue, romance, you know, great challenge, turning your potential enemies into your potential friends. I mean, a great job, sure. Right? Now I have to deal with the common folks who would simply grumbling and, you know, saying what they felt was wrong with the country. And this kind of a new experience made me simply think again about the Soviet system as a whole. By then, the Soviet economic performance was declining. The degradation of Brezhnev was too obvious. In the early 80s, before his death, he was really a walking corpse. You know,
I remember.
The Politburo decisions were based on glorification of its own deeds. You know, I mean, it was truly the duplicity of the system, the falsehoods, and the mistreatment of its own people. Well, I was not an exceptional case. There were millions of Russians who felt the same way. And it was Mr. Gorbachev, the party functionary, who felt the same way too. And when he came to power, he decided to overhaul the Soviet system because he felt that something went wrong and something had to be done. So I became immediately Mr. Gorbachev's admirer and supporter, at least at the initial stage.
Were
in
you
1985.
Close to him?
Oh, no. I was still in Leningrad.
Yeah.
I watched him on television, and I met him only once when he came to Leningrad. That was in the summer of 85, I believe, soon after he was elevated to his position. And I simply followed him and his wife as a senior official of the KGB in the region. But I admired his courage, and I wanted a change, like millions of my countrymen. You know, encouraged by Mr. Gorbachev's appeal to the Russians to do something in a new way, I wrote a letter to the Party Central Committee about corruption in Leningrad party and government organizations. And within 2 weeks, a commission arrived from Moscow to investigate me, not the facts, which I had provided. So to me, it was a reminder that Gorbachev may think one way, but his environment.
So you were a whistleblower, but the other guys controlled the whistles.
Absolutely right. So what I did next, I sat down and wrote a letter to Mr. Gorbachev in person. That was January of 1987. In that letter, I stated that the KGB has become a state within the state, and if Mr. Gorbachev does not destroy it, they will destroy him. That was the message. I also offered to restructure the Soviet society as a whole. It was a very loyal letter. I mean, loyal to Mr. Gorbachev and his reforms. And the letter was handed over to him by my good friend, Mr. Yakovlev, who was my a colleague during Columbia University days in 1958-59. We remained friends.
So Gorbachev
still friends
received
the
letter.
Right. Gorbachev received that letter from Mr. Yakovlev's hands. Before this happened, by the way, I gave the letter for Mr. Yakovlev to read. It was a 12-page letter. And I was not sure what Mr. Yakovlev's reaction would be because he was a Politburo member, man next to Gorbachev. And I was truly nervous, jittery. I thought, Jesus, what if he says it's trash? Throw it away. And he read it, said, all correct, I'll give it to Gorbachev. So I was very pleased that I am not the only maverick, someone who has a special view. He also had the same view. And I say millions of Russians had similar views.
Did you get a reaction from Gorbachev?
Well, I was immediately recalled from Leningrad to Moscow. That was the first reaction. Now, I was put in charge of the Soviet Academy of Sciences Counterintelligence Division. So my job was now to look after the Soviet scientists and the, classified research and whatever they did. I had to keep an eye on that. It was purely internal security job. Later on, I was transferred to the Ministry of Electronic Industries with the same mission. And then, when I reached 55, I was summoned to the personnel department of the KGB, and they told me, Mr. Killigan, you work so well. You're a good, great officer, but it's time for you to go. Had I been quiet and obedient servant of for whoever is in charge, I could have served for another 10 years because it's not mandatory age. Sure. I could stay on the job till 70 or 75. But anyway, they were sorry, and I said, I'm happy, because I was already fully, I mean, prepared to leave. And the moment I got my ID card as a retired general, I went into the offices of the Russian Democratic Movement and introduced myself and said, I wish to work for a change in Russia. So I sided with those who were opposing Gorbachev, who thought that Gorbachev was not doing enough, that he was...
This was Yeltsin's movement?
It was, yes. Yeltsin was one of part of that movement. Yeah. That's correct. And then out of this KGB now, I felt free to, well, denounce my own organization. When I was inside, I wrote letters, as I explained, to the party officials, Gorbachev, Party Central Committee, but now I felt free to speak out. And I denounced the KGB. I said things which I had written Gorbachev, I mean publicly. And the reaction followed almost immediately. Gorbachev issued a decree stripping me of my rank, decorations, and pension. That was 1990. And the military prosecutor launched an investigation charging me with leaking state secrets. Well, I would probably land in jail in the next few weeks or months, but the mood in the country was already absolutely uncontrollable, you know. People wanted a change so badly that despite my background, I mean as a KGB officer, I was elected by over a million people, a member of the Soviet legislature.
So they couldn't imprison
me. Supreme Soviet. No, I obtained immunity from prosecution. And that made me, well, a free man in a sense, because right. I could now travel abroad. I could speak whatever I wanted to say. And that was the beginning of my new career as a public figure.
We have to take a break. When we come back, I would like to get your analysis of Vladimir Putin. How did he become president? And what should we understand about him from an American perspective? We'll be right back after these messages.
Here's how you can become a citizen lobbyist and influence how your representatives vote. Write a letter to your congressmen and senators. Speak out on a call-in talk radio program. Write a letter to the editor of your local newspaper and call the Conservative Caucus for more information at 703-938-9626.
Welcome back. I'm Howard Phillips with Oleg Kalugin. Oleg, we have just 2.5 minutes, and I want to get your assessment of why Putin was snatched from relative obscurity by Yeltsin to become his successor, and how should we as Americans, in your view, evaluate Putin?
From what I know from my Moscow sources, Mr. Putin, when he was in charge of the FSB, Russian equivalent of the FBI, was tasked by Mr. Yeltsin with a very sensitive mission. At that time, the Prosecutor General of the Russian Federation, Mr. Skuratov, inadvertently leaked some stories related to Yeltsin's family corruption. Yeltsin was so furious, he did not know how to get rid of that Prosecutor General. He really compromised the president of the country. Well, it's against the constitution of the Russian Federation to kick the prosecutor general by the presidential decree.
Separation of powers.
Absolutely. So he turned to Mr. Putin. Mr. Putin was the chief of the FSB. And he said, can you do the job? And Putin said, yes. Because that was a character of Mr. Putin, to be loyal to those who picked him up, who made him what he was at the time, And he performed it.
Even if it meant circumventing the law.
Absolutely right.
We have just 1 minute. What happened then?
What happened that Mr. Putin organized, he framed the prosecutor general. A couple of prostitutes were introduced to him. He was taken to a sauna and then videotaped. And within a week it was shown on Russian public television. The prosecutor's fate was sealed. He was...
Why are you here instead of in Russia? Is it because Mr. Putin has a grudge against you?
Well, it's not Mr. Putin's personal grudge, though we did have some exchanges in public. It's simply my unacceptance of what's happening in Russia. Mr. Putin's heart and soul belong to the Soviet system. But in his mind, he's young enough and smart enough to understand that Russia cannot go back economically. It has to integrate itself with the Western society.
So basically, he is doing what he perceives to be essential to the interest of Russia.
Absolutely.
And making no gratuitous concessions.
No.
Thank you so much for being with us,
Oleg Kalugin.
Thanks for joining us on Conservative Roundtable.
Well, there you have it. And I suppose I should thank the Conservative Caucus. I'm not a member nor a supporter or endorser of that organization, or maybe even their suggestions for you to become a lobbyist. I think that's the major problem that we have in this country, the ability to behind closed doors, even out in the open, influence members of our elected body who are to represent our interests in the name of the Constitutional Republic of the United States of America. Not the Illuminati version, not the Federal Reserve version. This last clip I played with the hospitality of Don Newsom at BBS Radio, extending the show a little bit so I could follow up the first two clips that I played, thanks to G. Edward Griffin and Yuri Bezmenov, to whom we are also grateful for the information. I should say that former Major General, now Professor Oleg Kalugin, is a very charming man and appears to be very honest about his past. His schooling at Columbia University, unlike a usurper in office right now, most likely we could obtain records of that. But even as a student, he was approached with the intention to recruit him into a spy network to which he already belonged. That shows you what's going on. Now, I don't have anything disparaging to say about this man. He shares a lot of information, but there you have a pretty accurate accounting of how these intelligence agencies work. While I was listening to him speak, I reminded myself of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, an invasion that occurred over a 10-year period. And the Afghanis were supplied weapons and munitions and all the money and the things they needed by the U.S. government. I suppose their interest may have had some strategic connotations in terms of being able to move oil through the region or obtain oil through the region. But more likely the ancient history of Afghanistan, the connections to space and certainly the poppy fields and the amount of money to be made there. That's the only reason we are in Afghanistan. The poppy fields finance what's going on in the space industry. And there are some very, very ancient connections in that regard to why anyone would, with a military industrial congressional complex that has the power to go into another country and just take it over for financial gain, All the earmarks are there. All the indicators are there as to why we are there in Afghanistan. And it has absolutely nothing to do with Osama bin Laden. This last clip that we listened to was recorded in 2001, prior to 9/11, or there would have been some mention of 9/11, I would assume. I don't have the actual date that the broadcast was recorded. However, when we look at what's going on with this international intelligence battle, this fight for information, and the different stories that are told to the public, what we are taught about who the enemy is and the purpose of the Cold War, and these people are our enemies. There's also no mention of the prior infiltration that I referenced at the top of the show, that we had already been infiltrated, that we had financed the Soviet Union's participation in World War II, or at least Russia, we'll say. And you're hearing the character of the leaders, the leadership role in the Kremlin, the Politburo, and what their concerns were within the country itself and the concerns of the people. This is government against government, but they work secretly together while all the while telling us that they're mortal enemies. And they have infiltrated the country. This man was able as a spy to infiltrate the country and enter Columbia University, the same school alleged to be the second school of higher education that the no-legged Mac Daddy attended. Of course, we can't get any records for that. Is there any surprise? I might add, too, that Professor Kalugin didn't refer to any notes, and he certainly wasn't reading a teleprompter, even though he was filmed in a TV studio. No teleprompter. He didn't need one. He was telling the truth. He's speaking for himself. We should have a leader that can do that. Number one, the leader should be an American. I don't think anyone would dispute that. And I will have another article, an addendum to parts 3 through 7B of Three Stooges Go to Washington, that describes the aberrations and the anomalies that have occurred since all my exposures about the true nature of who this individual is. And he's certainly spouting the rhetoric that we heard in the first two clips from a former KGB operative, diplomat, journalist, and someone who is alleged to be a defector of the former Soviet Union. Here we heard from two defectors. Let's, at face value, let's say that they are actual defectors. What purpose does this information serve if we do nothing about the information? If we don't demand that our leaders avoid corruption and compromise? Well, he described the way they were set up. He described in a couple of sentences how Putin set up a prosecutor who was trying to discredit Yeltsin, Boris Yeltsin. Yeltsin had all kinds of problems. He had a heavy drinking problem, but he was probably targeted with some of the same technology that others are targeted with. You heard them describe going to prison or a mental institution. This is how they deal with the people who speak the truth, who speak out against the corrupt interests of these individuals that want to run the whole planet and degrade your quality of life or even deprive you of your life, a God-given right that you have. I've used up quite a bit of time, and I want to thank Don Newsom for allowing me to add this portion because it really drives the nail in the coffin. And I'd remind you that on the heels of World War II, Reinhard Gehlen was a double agent for for both the CIA and at least the KGB. He was sharing information about the United States with the former Soviet Union and sharing the information with the American government about the former Soviet Union. He was a Nazi. He worked hand in hand with Martin Bormann. He worked with Otto Skorzeny. He definitely worked with the guy calling himself George H.W. Bush, who I've outed in a series of articles back in 2007, identifying him as George H.W. Scherf. New information even shows that he may have been Walter Scherf from the Dachau trials. Of course, these criminals were all let go and released because the long-term goal was to infiltrate and tear down the United States of America. And that is going on today. Trust me, there'll be much more information about this coming forth on future shows. I appreciate you listening in. I want to thank Wind Talkers Radio Network for broadcasting the show. Over at BBS Radio tonight, Don Newsom. I want to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. And most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me tomorrow night. My special guests will be Mr. Ken Adachi and Z.S. Livingstone. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.